The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're back in the friendly confines of the Ed Stone studio on a very chilly afternoon. It's a bit of a cold spell this week, kind of drizzly rain, and the temperatures down in the, I guess, the upper 40s at night, and then through the 50s in the daytime. So for June, it doesn't feel like summer just yet, but it'll warm up, I'm sure. And I'm sure it'll be a shock to our system when we spend some time in the United States here in the coming weeks. I'm not sure how hot it is in Oklahoma, but of course Oklahoma has some pretty uncomfortably warm summers at times, so we'll see when we get there, I suppose. Today I want to talk about a number of things, but there are a couple of themes that I think will emerge in the second segment. We'll focus on the work, God's work, that is. We played on yesterday's show, in case you didn't hear it, there was this montage from the French members, the brethren in France and Belgium, that have shown such enthusiastic support for God's work, in some cases for many, many decades. Following that, and even what the Feast of Pentecost is all about, I think that there will be a nice focus on a Pentecost theme as we talk about God's work and even get into how God works. So we'll look into that in the second segment. And also, I think with the first and the second segment, you'll see a history theme emerge as well. It's, as I've been telling my son, it's been just an amazing blessing for him and some of his friends in school and the academy that have been able to tour through historical sites. Of course, they had their senior trip just a few weeks ago, and then my son came with us over the weekend into France, where we saw a number of things. If you've been listening to the program, you know about some of the sites that we visited, but I keep emphasizing just how much of a blessing it is to dig into this history, especially, as we'll see from one story I have here in just a moment, especially when you see, in the case of D-Day, you see this generation dying off. There's a story from Foreign Policy, D-Day's dying legacy. We'll come to that in just a second. But let me begin with this story in Politico on Germany's military maneuvers. Here again, if you're grounded in history, you see this this headline, you read the story, and it immediately should concern you, as you have high-ranking German officials. They're drawing up plans. Well, right now, I guess they're contemplating whether or not they're going to send a warship through the Taiwan Strait. But this breaks from what's been the norm since the close of World War II. Politico says high-ranking officials are contemplating sending a warship through the Taiwan Strait, joining the U.S. and France, and challenging Beijing's claims to what the West regards as an international waterway. It says if Chancellor Angela Merkel's government actually goes ahead, it will be a remarkable revision of its "we keep out of conflict" reflexes. Germany will be openly backing its allies in a strategy certain to be found provocative by the country's enforcers of non-combatant passivity. So again, you could look at this. If you're not grounded in history, if you know nothing about Bible prophecy, you could look at this and say, well, what's the big deal? They're just doing what the United States is doing. They're just doing what France is doing. But the mindset is changing. And that's brought out in this article. It talks about Germany's reluctance Since World War II, Germany's reluctance to engage. But that's changing. That mindset is changing. And this is not a good thing. Not if you understand history. It says a German official informed me of the Taiwan Strait plan last month. It says last week, a second German official, at my request, confirmed its discussion by the defense ministry. No firm decision was expected before the end of the summer. But then listen to this last statement. It says there are German officials who want to combat the notion that the country is an irresponsible and noncommittal ally. They want to step forward. And as we've brought out on this program over and again, they're being urged to do so, even from the United States, even from Great Britain, certainly from France. And so you have these high-ranking German officials. They want to combat this notion that we're passive. They want to combat this notion that we're reluctant to engage. They want to change. They want to change in the mindset. And that's coming. Your Bible prophesies that that change is coming. It's happening even now. Wait until the Daniel 8 man comes on the scene. But all of this, as people around the world continue on with their heads in the sand, they continue on in a deep sleep. This foreign policy piece, D-Day's dying legacy, it says the last survivors of the Normandy invasion and history's worst war are almost gone. How long will the international system they helped create survive them? It's a sobering warning here. It talks about how that there's not many of them left. That was something that was impossible not to see when you're at those many commemorations last week at D-Day. We were at Utah Beach, as I mentioned last week. I think the ceremony we attended, there were only four or five World War II veterans in attendance. There were quite a few more there at Omaha Beach with the group that listened to President Trump. But he said there at the beginning of his speech, he honored those veterans, and then he mentioned how many of them were there. This is what the president said last Thursday, clip one.
Today we remember those who fell, and we honor all who fought right here in Normandy. They won back this ground for civilization to more than 170 veterans of the Second World War who join us today. You are among the very greatest Americans who will ever live. You are the pride of our nation. You are the glory of our republic. And we thank you from the bottom of our hearts. Here with you are over 60 veterans who landed on D-Day. Our debt to you is everlasting. Today we express our undying gratitude.
That's the president from last Thursday, the 75th anniversary of the Normandy landings. And he noted there 170 veterans, 60 veterans who landed on D-Day, 170 total from the Second World War. But they're dying off. How many will be left at the 80th anniversary? There's only a few left today. Foreign policy says the living memory of humankind's worst self-made calamity is dying off with them. individual by individual. That's why the speech that the president gave Thursday was so moving. You can't hear that without being moved to tears. That history, the sacrifice, the love of country, the acknowledgement of God, our Creator, who intervened on our behalf in so many different ways. We'll talk more about that in the second segment. It says, before very long, World War II will no longer dwell in the minds of those who endured its horrors, but will pass entirely into the dry pages of history. It can hardly be a coincidence that slowly, almost imperceptibly, the lessons of the bloodiest century are fading from memory as well. You see, it's one thing for these veterans to die off, but the lessons are fading from memory. He says here, the stark lines of the world order we know today, the international institutions and norms intended to prevent such a calamity from happening ever again, were set down by a deeply traumatized generation that witnessed these terrible events firsthand and sustained by that generation's children and grandchildren. They witnessed it. They were deeply traumatized by it. They established institutions to ensure it would never happen again. It says, now with the witness bearers almost gone, these lines are being rethought and reconsidered, or more often, simply ignored and forgotten. This author referred to the Portsmouth ceremony, the one we saw on June 5th, last Wednesday. He mentioned Queen Elizabeth, her comments. She's 93 years of age, and as she pointed out, she didn't think she'd be around this long to to participate in this kind of a anniversary. But then the Queen said that the heroism, the courage, the sacrifice of those who lost their lives will never be forgotten. Foreign Policy says perhaps, but what is being forgotten ever so gradually is what they sacrificed themselves for. The historical reasons behind the United States' role as chief author, overseer, and stabilizer of the liberal global system. Why is it? Why did the United States emerge as a global policeman? Well, in large part because we couldn't have this happen again. Never again. Two horrific, interconnected world wars. Surely we can't have a third one. Well, this article talks about now the rise of the new right in Europe, Japan, elsewhere. It says it's about a new forgetfulness, this age that we're in. At times, a willful amnesia that's spreading through the capitals of the war's former combatants, Russian President Vladimir Putin, as part of his broad program to create an us-versus-them narrative against the West, has suggested that Russia could have defeated Nazi Germany largely on its own. Well, Joseph Stalin didn't even believe that. But now here comes Vladimir Putin. And just like many leaders in the West, he's revising the history. He's rewriting it to make Russia look better and stronger, more capable of dominating the world. Foreign Policy says, whatever happened to the prediction of Hans Frank, the senior Nazi convicted at Nuremberg, that 1,000 years will pass and this guilt of Germany will still not be erased. Well, we've barely passed 70 to 75 years. And now you read about Germany changing its mindset, its military mindset, or reintroducing it, combating the notion that it's an irresponsible or non-committal ally. We've got to change this, say the German officials. Foreign policy reminds us that following the war, it was Dwight Eisenhower who headed up the D-Day landings. And then finally, the victory against Germany. And he insisted on filming the Nazi concentration camps. He insisted on witnessing it himself. He wanted the firsthand evidence for those that would come along later and revise the history. Those who would come along later and spread propaganda. Eisenhower knew that would happen. Today, so much of it's just being forgotten. Foreign policy says, how long before the urgent lessons that drove international changes after the war are forgotten as well? It says in the conclusion here, living memory, of course, is no guarantee against the falsification of history. The Nazis rose to power by spreading an absurd myth about events that many of their generation had only just lived through. That Germany was stabbed in the back by the Jews in World War I. The Japanese, even as they bent to U.S. domination after defeat, and still do for the most part, have encouraged the myth since the war that they were mainly victims. But remaking or forgetting history becomes much easier after all the participants have died out. It becomes much easier to erase it when the victims are gone. They're already doing it with the Holocaust. They're already doing it with World War II, with World War I. When the participants die out, well, the legacy for far too many people, the legacy also is buried. American Greatness had a piece about the study of Western civilization. And it goes back and talks about how from the 60s on through to the 70s and 80s, the protesting that basically pushed Western civilization out of the university. And this is an older gentleman who went to college in the 1960s, explaining how the study of Western civilization was pretty much replaced with multiculturalism. It says here, this is his example, when I attended college in the 1960s, taking and passing the year-long course in the history of Western civilization was required for graduation. The point of that requirement was perfectly clear. Students were expected to be proficient with the major works of their civilization if they were to be awarded a degree. It says, it was the mark of an educated person to know these things. Because it was a required course, it was taught by a senior professor in a large lecture hall with hundreds of students. The course was no walk in the park, he says. He's talking about in the 1960s. When I took the course, only one student got an A grade for the first semester. Students went down in wave after wave. Many dropped out of the course, planning to try again later. Others dropped out of school or transferred to another college or university. It was that difficult. It was that challenging. And yet no one complained. It was expected. It says student protests were all the rage on campus in those days, but nobody protested the Western Civ course, its contents, the difficulty involved, or the fact that it was required. Students evidently accepted the idea that studying the story of how we got here and who shaped that story was essential to becoming an educated person. Well, then he talks about these protests that came along later in the 1980s. Jesse Jackson leading one in 1987 against, I think it was Stanford. leading the way with the chants, "Hey, hey, ho, ho, Western Civ has got to go." The article says here, many of the faculty, after all, he's referring now back to the 1960s. He says here, well, let me just back up. It says, it is also not at all clear that the faculty in those days would have raced to appease student protesters chanting, "Hey, hey, ho, ho, Western Civ has got to go." Many of the faculty, after all, had served in World War II. My best friend on the faculty had, my best friends on the faculty had all served either in the European or the Pacific Theater. These are the teachers in the 1960s. They had put their lives on the line to defend Western civilization and served with others who had lost their lives in that fight. Whether they were teaching Plato or Italian art of the Renaissance and the Baroque eras, they taught with the passion of men who had fought as soldiers and were working as teachers to preserve Western culture. It says, perhaps my fellow students would not have dared to present our teachers with that particular protest. They wouldn't dare do it. But when they die off, you see, it's so much easier to challenge the narratives, to challenge the history, to challenge the story, and even change it or erase it. There was another article recently, by the way, about George Orwell's classic, 1984, reaching its 70-year anniversary. And the article pointed out how that it's seeing a surge in popularity in recent years because it was so prescient, spot on with the direction of our society. Some can recognize this as it's happening. You do see a pretty good article from time to time, like this one I just read to you from American Greatness, or the foreign policy piece. It's sad, though, what's happening to our educational system, to what's happening to our young people, the oncoming generation. You see that level of sacrifice that was on display last week, and then consider what so many of our young people today, so many of our children today complain about, so many of our adults. Think about what we're complaining about, what we get frustrated by. Well, it's good to remember that history, and it's certainly effective and important when our children can study it and see it for themselves as well. When we come back, we'll talk more about God's work and our support of that work. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. World War III is closer than you think. Terrorism and economic crisis is tearing Europe apart. The only nation that can lead Europe out of the mess is Germany. But Germany can't do it without a strong leader. Bible prophecy says they will get one. He will unite Europe in a new Holy Roman Empire. But it won't stop there. Every time Europe unites, war breaks out. Find out how it will happen again, one last time. Request a free copy of The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. What will the Holy Roman Empire do after it has stopped terrorism and saved Europe's economy? This book will tell you. You'll be shocked at how much it will affect your future. Act today. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From from the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England. This is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
When we were talking to some of our French listeners, some of our brethren in France and Belgium on Sunday, and as I said, we played some of that audio for you on yesterday's program, but it was just an awesome thing to see how fervent their passion and desire for supporting God's work really and truly is. Their hearts are in God's work. And when they talked about the work, when they talked about the French translations or the TV programs or what they're able to pick up from the English website, these are people that really are consuming everything that the work of God is producing. They're lending their support to this worldwide work. I emphasized the work and our support for it at the Cardiff campaign a little over a week ago. And that's the second evening of the two-night event. And I referred to God the Father and Jesus Christ and the fact that they work. Like Jesus said in John 5, "My Father works hitherto and I work." We're always working. In John 9 and verse 4, Jesus said, "I must work the works of him that sent me. While it is day, the night comes when no man can work." Christ said, look, we've got to get the work done. Night is coming. There's coming a time when we won't be able to work. And so we really better get busy and do the work while we have the time. Finish this work while we have the opportunity to do so. Herbert Armstrong wrote a coworker letter. Of course, so many of his letters revolved around the work. There was a real sense of urgency in every message that he sent out to his readers. This one goes back to 1955. And in it, he's explaining something about God's work. Something that, as he said, the coworkers and even the members of the church maybe didn't quite understand like they should have. How God works. He says, of course, God can just rain down money from heaven for us. So why doesn't he do it? You think of the many ways that God could finance this work. He's God, after all. He's the creator of the universe. There could be piles and piles of money that show up outside of headquarters today. But that's not the way God works. He doesn't do his work that way. He's working out a tremendous purpose here below. And we're part of that. We have a most important part in that divine purpose. Mr. Armstrong says, God is working out a very special purpose in you and in me as co-workers, as his instruments, through whom he, the very eternal, carries out his work. So here is God presiding over his family, presiding over the family business. And he's trying to get all of us as his instruments to do just a little bit more, to shoulder our burden, his burden, to become more productive, more efficient, more fruitful, to grow. He went on to explain in this letter that, and he relies on several scriptures in doing so, how that God didn't intend for our Christian life to be a soft bed of roses, as he says in this article. He didn't say, when we counted the cost, God didn't say, look, you're not going to have any trouble. There's not going to be any concerns along the way. It's just going to be smooth and easy. It says here, God intended, ordained, that we should be confronted with continual problems, difficulties, troubles, that we should have to make constant sacrifices, learning to give up our own ways and wants, even some of our money, and the things we want to buy with it. Well, as I say, you can look at Matthew 7, verses 13 and 14. Straight is the gate. Enter you in at the straight gate. Narrow is the way. God's way of life is hard. It's challenging. It's difficult. It's fraught with troubles and tests and trials. Many are the afflictions of the righteous. But the thing of it is that psalm, that same psalm brings out, God will deliver us out of them. And Paul said in 1 Corinthians 10 that we won't suffer, or God won't suffer us to be tempted above what we're able to bear. Jesus said in Matthew 11, look, if you feel like you're laboring and you're heavy laden with burden, then go to God so that God can make that burden light, so that God can lighten the load, so that God can deliver us, so that God can get us through. Going back to that coworker letter from 1955, it says, by its very nature, God's work must keep on growing. Like the grain of mustard seed, it starts as perhaps the smallest religious work on earth today. All works of religion are not God's work, but this work, God's work, has proved by its fruits to be the very work of God. It's the most important activity on earth today. That's what I was encouraging the trumpet readers at the Cardiff campaign to do. Look, go and find where God is working. Look for the fruits. And once you find it, then pour your heart into supporting it. The one true church. The one true work. Mr. Armstrong said, Jesus said, this gospel of God's kingdom shall be preached unto the world as a witness to all nations before the end of this world. Already it reaches around the world, but we are still far from reaching every nation. It's got to go right around the world, Mr. Armstrong said. And of course, he said in other writings that that's the reason why God brought so many people into the church in these last days. During that Philadelphia era, because of the needs for the work. Tens of thousands of people, millions of plain truth readers coming into the true church, a worldwide work. Now the biggest membership, or the nation that had the most in terms of members, that's the United States, far and away the United States, and then Canada, and you go right down the line with Australia and Britain. I don't have the list in front of me. But this was a work, as we know, that was and still is headquartered in Manassas, the United States. And there's a reason for that. He explains that in this letter as well. It's a powerful letter. Let me just give you some background, though, first. Genesis 48. This is when the birthright blessings were conferred upon Ephraim and Manasseh. Genesis 48 and verse 5, and now your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, which were born unto you in the land of Egypt before I came unto you into Egypt, are mine, as Reuben and Simeon. They shall be mine. So, as Mr. Armstrong explained in the U.S. and Britain in Prophecy, Israel here, He adopted these two as his very own. Verse 9, it says, and Joseph said to his father, they are my sons whom God has given me in this place. And he said, bring them, I pray you, unto me, and I will bless them. Now the eyes of Israel were dim for age, so that he could not see, and he brought them near to him, and he kissed them and embraced them. Then you skip down to verse 13. This is Genesis 48. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim in his right hand toward Israel's left hand, and Manasseh in his left hand toward Israel's right hand, and brought them near unto him. So the hands were crossed. Verse 14, and Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it upon Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand upon Manasseh's head, guiding his hands wittingly, for Manasseh was the firstborn. And he blessed Joseph and said, God, before whom my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, did walk, the God which fed me all my life long and to this day, the angel which redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. And let my name be named on them, and the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac. And let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. You can read a lot more about this in the United States and Britain in Prophecy. Let me just refer you again to the 1955 article where Mr. Armstrong said, notice Israel did not confer this blessing on just one, but on both. Bless the lads, he said. The blessing went upon them jointly. Let my name be named on them. That was part of the blessing. His name was Israel. And so who is Israel today? Well, obviously, it's the descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh. That's what your Bible says. Satan has blinded the world to this truth. Later on in the article, Mr. Armstrong said, thus it is that many of the prophecies about Israel or Jacob do not refer to Jews or to any of the nations that are today the descendants of the other tribes of Israel. Few indeed are the clergymen, theologians, or professed Bible scholars who know that today. Many refuse to know it. It says, together the descendants of these two lads, Ephraim and Manasseh, were to grow into a promised multitude, the nation and company of nations. These birthright blessings, they've been poured down upon our peoples jointly, the United States and Britain. Verse 18 here, it says, and Joseph said to his father, not so, my father, for this is the firstborn. Put your right hand upon his head. And his father refused and said, I know it, my son, I know it. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great, but truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his seed shall become a multitude of nations. So Ephraim, as we know, he went on to become greater because of the empire. The sun never set on that empire. Verse 20 says, and he blessed them that day, saying, in you shall Israel bless, saying, God make you as Ephraim and as Manasseh. And he set Ephraim before Manasseh. Just back up over to Genesis 35. Verse 11, it says, and God said unto him, I am God Almighty, be fruitful and multiply a nation. There's Manasseh, and a company of nations shall be of you, and kings shall come out of your loins. Now you look at the history here again, the history of these past two centuries. Riveting history, it should be. Fulfilled prophecy. Mr. Armstrong talks about this in that 1955 letter. He talks about it elsewhere, too. This is from January 1980, a Plain Truth magazine. It says, the big colony, Ephraim, was to lose was the United States, descended from co-birthright holder Manasseh. It says the United States became the one promised great nation. Britain became the great commonwealth of nations. Listen to this. Neither Great Britain nor America deserved the unprecedented wealth, greatness, and national power of Abraham's birthright. But God had promised it unconditionally to Abraham. It was conditional to ancient Israel. So we didn't deserve it. But God made this unconditional promise to Abraham. Here again, he says, though our two great peoples did not deserve it, God was bound and kept his promise. Yet once God had fulfilled his promise to Abraham by giving us that national wealth, power, and greatness, it became conditional on us whether we should retain it. Notice that. Those birthright blessings in these latter days, they became conditional once we received them because God fulfilled his promise. God poured out those blessings upon us. So in a lot of ways, we find ourselves in the same situation that they were in ancient Israel, where it was conditional. They went into captivity and slavery. Of course, we're losing all of those blessings. We're losing those birthright blessings and captivity and slavery is coming again for the people of Israel. Look at what's happened again since the great, let's just go back to World War II. Go back 75 years, go back to the so-called greatest generation and look at the decline. Just look at it. Look at the moral decline. Look at the difference between that generation that stormed the beaches of Normandy and the snowflakes on the university campus today. Dramatic decline. We see it everywhere. Mr. Armstrong wrote back in the September 1966 Plain Truth. Listen to this. This is true history. This is an understanding of history with the light of Bible prophecy helping to just enlighten our understanding that much more. It says in 1966, Mr. Armstrong did, our armed forces did not win World War I or World War II, believe it or not. God caused the defeat of Germany and Japan. That's why you see God's timely intervention, like in the case of the weather on June 6th, 1944. It's so easy to forget this. God caused it. See, it's even if you're grounded in history, even if you love America, even if you're a patriot, it's still easy to look at this history and think that, well, we did this ourselves. What a great generation they were. That generation that stormed the beaches. And yet, look at why it had to come to that even. 1944 happened because of the spirit of appeasement in 1938. And it was so strong. And were it not for Winston Churchill, now his office was prophesied, Ezekiel 33, were it not for him, Western civilization would not have survived. The United States, remember, they were dragging their feet years into the war. We had to be bombed into the war. It took Pearl Harbor to get the United States to act. It took some unbelievable miracles for the U.S. and Britain to win that war, to come out on top in that worldwide struggle. Why did it happen? Why were we spared? In that 66 article, Mr. Armstrong says, the British Empire is a thing of the past. Britain's sun has set. He writes, the United States came to great world power a little bit later. The United States sun sets a little later than England's. So this is why we've had a relatively smooth transition of power from Great Britain to the United States of America. This is why the world has been relatively stable, at least for the West, since the end of World War II. But you certainly can't say that since that war ended, that we've just had blessings and peace and tranquility all around the world ever since. I think it was, it's in Neil Ferguson's book, The War of the World. He estimates that there's something like 12 wars or civil wars or mass genocide, whatever it was, in the 20th century, 12 of them were where there were over a million casualties. So it wasn't just World War I and World War II. But I want to focus more on the Second World War and why the United States and Britain prevailed. You heard what Mr. Armstrong said there. It was God who caused this to happen. Why did he cause it? Let me switch back to that 1955 letter. Mr. Armstrong says, now let me explain our present turning point. No other nation on earth today could finance such a huge undertaking except the United States. So keep in mind, in this coworker letter, he's talking about the work and how God works. How God works through human instruments. He could rain money down from heaven, but he doesn't do that. That's not the way he fulfills his purpose, his plan. He says, I want you to understand this. Why do you suppose God raised up his work here in America? The ancient birthright went to Ephraim and Manasseh jointly at first, but primarily to Ephraim. Ephraim, remember, was the great empire. The multitude of nations. Mr. Armstrong says, we are actually Manasseh today. America, that is. The British are the birthright nation Ephraim. Now, why didn't God raise up his work for these last days over in England? There's one very practical reason. God kept his great unconditional birthright promise. He made Britain and America the wealthiest, richest nations of all Earth's history. But today we're very near the end of this age. Already the British, who came up to world dominance and economic prosperity first, have reached and passed their zenith of up to of national prosperity, it says. Now the British are on the decline, both in world power and in economic dominance. He says today the British are not prosperous enough so that their people could, by God's system of tithes and voluntary free will offerings, finance such a powerful worldwide campaign as God's work must become today. He said in 1955, British money cannot carry the gospel to other nations around the world. But today, America has just reached the very pinnacle of its tremendous worldwide power and is soaring at the very height of economic prosperity, the greatest height ever enjoyed by any nation of any time or generation. He says, co-workers, do you suppose this is all just circumstance? Of course not. This is no accident. It's by God's design. God's behind this. God caused the Allies to come out victorious in World War II, as we read earlier. It says, you are far more prosperous today than you would be if this great nation of ours were not in such a wave of prosperity. Mr. Armstrong says, you co-workers are not the rich or the wealthy, I know. God's people seldom are. Usually they are among the more poor. But listen, God has made this nation so prosperous that even we people, whom God has called as co-workers together in this work, have far more money than we could have had or than we could have except for this national prosperity, which no other nation enjoys today. History has never seen something like this. And I think this is something to keep in mind, even as we consider why the temporary resurgence. Saving America temporarily. We were in France over the weekend, and I think there's two shut-ins, and then 14 people coming from Belgium and France. Two Western nations, Israelite nations, and that's all the people that we have there. And yet, as I said, they're very dedicated and loyal. Their hearts are in the work. And you cross the Atlantic, and of course, there's thousands. There's several thousand. There's tens of thousands of trumpet readers. Proportionally, that's the same way it was during the days of of Mr. Armstrong. And there's a reason why the work is headquartered there. I want to just give you a short quote from Neil Ferguson's book, the one I just mentioned, The War of the World. But you get into his introduction there here in this book, and it's almost like it's something Mr. Armstrong wrote. You'll remember him talking often about the paradox. All of this advancement, all of this prosperity and wealth, and yet at the same time, we've lived through a century of one violent and bloody struggle after another. Ferguson says, what made the 20th century, and particularly the 50 years from 1904 to 1953, so bloody that this era was exceptionally violent may seem paradoxical. After all, the 100 years after 1900 were a time of unparalleled progress in real terms. It has been estimated average per capita global domestic product, an approximate measure of the average individual's income, allowing for fluctuations in the value of money, increased by little more than 50% between 1500, that's the time of Da Vinci, to 1870. That's a period of 370 years, where you just see incremental growth in people's prosperity. But it says here, between 1870 and 1998, that's just a little over a century, it increased by a factor of more than 6.5. Expressed differently, the compound annual growth rate was nearly 13 times higher between 1870 and 1998 than it was between 1500 and 1870. So, an explosion of growth and prosperity. And it just so happens that it occurred during that time period when the people of Israel, Ephraim and Manasseh specifically, received all of those blessings of prosperity and wealth. And of course, it's the United States in particular that has fueled that almost incomprehensible surge of wealth and prosperity that the whole world has benefited from. And so it should come as no surprise to know that this is where God positioned his headquarters. It all comes back to the work. The brethren in France understand this. The brethren in the UK understand this. The brethren in the United States, in Canada, in the Philippines, in Gentile nations, Israelite and Gentile. We have to look at these events. We have to look at this history. We have to look at the temporary resurgence. We have to look at all of this from God's perspective. It all comes back to the work. Mr. Armstrong said, today we are the richest, most prosperous nation on earth or in all world history. Today our government allows us to send as much money to any part of the world as we are able for spreading Christ's gospel. Today we're the only nation on earth whose God-fearing people could be able to finance this work of God into all nations. God has seen to it that we are both able, able and free to do it. God has seen to all of this. So here we are, just weeks away from what we hope will be a blitzkrieg of spiritual activity in North America with one pack after another. And there's plenty to think about with respect to God, his work, the support that it needs so that it can then go out to the world and reach farther into places like France and Belgium, the European work, the work in Judah, Isaiah 40, the work that goes out to Gentile lands as well. You can see why, as Mr. Armstrong explained back in 1955, you can see why God set up the work in this end time the way that he did. You can see why the American economic bubble has not yet burst. You can see why there's a temporary resurgence. Again, going back to the plain truth from years and years and years ago, one article from 1968. Why? It says, but why the continuous series of last-ditch rescues of the dollar and the pound? It says, for one reason, this work of God, proclaiming the truth of God's word to the entire world, is not yet finished. This is why the resurgence. You can just update these things to today and make the same point. Another article from 1968. God Almighty has a purpose in keeping the dollar strong. It's through the U.S. dollar that about 90% of God's worldwide work is financed. It says, when the Almighty God has completed his work, then the dollar will collapse. This is how we have to view these events that we talk often about on this program. Because everything in Bible prophecy, all of these end time events that we talk about on the show, all of it revolves around the work that God and his Son, Jesus Christ, are doing on this earth. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We thank you for joining us on today's program, and we'll see you again tomorrow.